Hello and welcome, members and guests, to the May 2nd program of the City Club of Eugene. Welcome to our KLCC listeners who listen to our programs at 6:30 p.m. on Monday nights and to our TV audience on community television. I'm Marty Wilde, City Club President. Our sponsors today are Sacred Earth Botanicals, Sanipac, Carried Away with Recycling, KLCC, and a special thank you to KPFF Consulting for our offices. We thank you for listening. These programs are free for our listening audience, yet there are costs involved. Your contribution is completely tax deductible and will help keep our organization healthy. Here's the organizer of today's program, John DeWinter, to introduce our speaker.
Thank you, Marty. It's true that what there is to learn about our universe is vast, and that the human mind's ability to learn is minuscule. Nevertheless, it seems to defy common sense that some of us refuse to accept the consensus of eminent scientists that the Earth's climate is warming at a dangerous rate, and that this change is being caused by human behavior, at least in significant part. Equally puzzling is the failure of those of us who accept the scientific consensus to modify our behavior to slow or reverse climate change. Today's program is not about whether global warming is occurring or whether human behavior is causing it. The program assumes the answers to these questions are in the affirmative. Instead, this program is about our attitudes and behavior in response to climate change. More specifically, it's about attitudes that present barriers to individual and societal behavioral change, and attitudes that might be tapped to produce necessary and desirable change. Our speaker, Tom Bowerman, is well qualified to discuss this subject. Tom is a true conservationist. In 1989, he helped found the Mackenzie River Trust, a nonprofit public benefit organization whose original mission was to protect the Mackenzie River from development and preserve the river's exceptional water quality. Since its founding, the Trust's mission has been expanded to protect and care for special lands and the rivers that flow through those lands in Western Oregon. Tom also has been a member of the board of directors of 1,000 Friends of Oregon. In 2013, Tom and his family made a substantial financial contribution to the University of Oregon's Environmental and Natural Resources Law Center. Speaking on behalf of his family at the time, Tom said his family's hope in making the contribution was to tap students' talent, energy, and enthusiasm for important policy research that provides a real value to our world. Tom also is a serious explorer of public attitudes and opinions, especially those about environmental issues, including climate change. Since 1998, he has conducted his explorations through Policy Interactive, a nonpartisan research firm he started to survey public opinions about climate change and how it may influence our future. The objective of these surveys has been to improve awareness of pressing environmental problems and improve the prospects of solutions supported by a broad segment of our society. Please welcome Tom Bowerman.
So I hope being a conservationist doesn't disqualify me from doing public opinion research, because we all know that public opinion research is subject to the researcher finding what they want to hear. And so in that context, I would always challenge my critics to ask the questions the way we ask them and see if they get different answers, or to criticize the way that we ask them. I'm going to draw today from some findings from the relatively current Oregon Values and Beliefs Project that I reported some of those results several months ago here. Thank you very much for having me back again so soon. The In that lead up to that presentation, I described the methodology, and I'm not going to repeat that today, but that's available on the Oregon Values and Beliefs website. You can just Google it. You'll get right there. Or True North is another way you can Google it. It's under those two titles, and you can look at the methodology itself. For the radio audience, I want to remind you that you can see these slides that I'm showing the audience here in the room today at policyinteractive.com/cityclub. That should take you right there. So the Values and Beliefs Project, which I'm only going to draw from a few because we asked 198 questions there and only about five questions were about climate change specifically, which is one of the good parts about working on that project, is that we covered many different aspects: jobs and economy, healthcare, energy, had some environmental issues generally in there, but very mixed bag. And I always think it's important to put the questions that I'm interested in the context of the broad social circumstances, so that we know that when we ask single purpose surveys that we get a bias, people become sensitized to the topic. And so I want to also disclaim, I'm going to break this presentation roughly into two halves, some results from the surveys that we've done, and also a very kind of opinion-oriented, and I want to stress that the sponsors that so graciously funded the Oregon Values and Beliefs Study, what I say and my opinions do not reflect their views necessarily. So one of the first questions we run into, which needs to be waylaid pretty quickly, is it a hoax? And this is not Oregon Values and Beliefs, but this is a survey done for the city of Eugene by DHM Research. And you can see that Eugenians, by 75%, responded with agreement. 53% strongly agree that climate change is occurring from human causes like burning fossil fuels. And 78% strongly disagreed that, or 63% strongly disagreed, but 78% total disagreement, climate change is from human causes, is a hoax and is not occurring. So moving right beyond that, because I think that that's relatively settled, and this being the People's Republic of Eugene, maybe people would say, well, yeah, this is unique, but we find this, actually, the same response characteristic in the state of Oregon and in the United States in general. It may vary by a few percentage points, maybe up to 10 percentage points, but given the strength of those figures, that's going to still be firm. So we are discussing it, but to also know that the 7% over there that strongly believe that it's a hoax, they do get a disproportionate amount of airtime, and so we hear that somewhat uncharacteristically sometimes. First, I'm going to go through a couple of worldview questions. We call them worldviews. It's our reference points. I talked about that in the last presentation. I like this question style. It's a forced choice. It puts two questions beside each other. It requires the respondent to choose which path. We also know that sometimes they don't have to be. You know, the relationship of economy and environment don't necessarily have to be always dichotomous, but occasionally we run into those forks in the road where they indeed, you have to make a decision one way or another. And so, looking at that, the statement A, which do you agree with more, which comes closest to your view? Statement A, climate change requires us to change our way of life, such as driving less or living more simply. Or statement B, that's 72% agree with that. Statement B, if climate change becomes a problem, we can deal with it later, 21%. And I'm going to read these, unfortunately, for you guys, because the radio audience may not have the opportunity of these graphics, so forgive me for that. And another question which becomes, oh, this is showing the results in the state of Oregon, by the way. So we can look at the regional differences. You can see that 72% to 21% really isn't that much different from the rest of Oregon. Eastern Oregon, which has a reputation for being relatively conservative, up at 62%, over a 2-to-1 ratio on that question. So we can see that across the state of Oregon, with all of the differences of ideology and et cetera, this is a pretty settled thing, and the idea in these question sorts, if you can study that a little bit, If climate change becomes a problem, we can deal with it later is a pretty soft statement. It gives them a way out pretty easily. And changing our way of life, such as driving less or living more simply, is pretty profound, really, if you stop and think about it. So in that context, it's going to give us a lead-in to looking at our attitudes. So here's one that's just much more specific. It had to do with a transportation question. We should invest more in roads for cars, statement A, 38%. We should invest more in public transportation, 53% in Oregon. And again, looking at the distribution regionally, the one area in Oregon that virtually has no public transportation at all, almost a dead heat, 50-50, close to 50-50, definitely within the margin of error. And so you can see that we have a population that both very generally and on specific issues is ready to take this challenge on in ways that might help address climate change. And indeed, we can see that from statistics, this is turning out to be true. People are behaving differently. That this is a large subject. I could spend 30 minutes talking about this slide by itself, but I'm just going to let that rest so I can get on with it. And here's an interesting one. Economic growth should be more important than addressing climate change. Now, this question styles what we call a probability desirability. And we ask them how likely it is to happen and then whether or not they think it's a good idea. Probability is 59% that economic growth will be more important than addressing climate change. The desirability of that statement drops to 37%. That seems to suggest that the distinction between what is often a policy, and if you read the guest opinion in the Register Guard yesterday morning, the policymakers are basically talking about economic growth and jobs all the time to the exclusion of some of these other environmental or climate change issues. There was one candidate among 48 that listed climate change once, and the jobs and economy was listed repeatedly virtually by every candidate except judgeships. There should be stronger governmental policies to reduce greenhouse gases. This is a style of question which is just what's called a Likert scale. It's a level of strongly desirable to strongly undesirable, 57%. Strongly desirable, 22%, strongly undesirable, 20% in the neutral zone. A carbon emission tax established to discourage greenhouse gas emissions and used to invest in green jobs and technologies. Strongly desirable, 50%. Just general combined desirable 50% and undesirable at 26%, a 2-to-1 ratio. However, when we do our work, this would not raise a policy maker's eyebrows in terms of getting this passed. 50% isn't going to do it. Even 60% probably isn't going to do it. This shows that we're getting into that area of the public trust in government and taxation issues. There's going to be some lift here if we're going to price it. This goes to, let me see if I skipped one here. Oh, this is a really interesting one. The level of disagreement to agreement on science and human ingenuity will solve climate change with little need to change our way of life. 61% disagree with that statement to 19% agree with that statement, which is rather interesting because in many respects there are three solutions or three major pathways of opinion about climate change. One is don't worry about it. Number two, worry about it and we're going to solve the problem through advancement in economic investments in science and technology. And number three is we're going to really need to change our way of life. And that's what we're finding about the general public sort of gets that component. But that isn't the one that you're going to hear about from the general policymaker elected representatives. And for a lot of reasons, that's another topic. We could talk about this for 30 minutes. But the important reason here is thinking about changing our way of life is that this is a very, very well-known formula, the IPAT formula, that impact equals population times affluence times technology. And each one of these, population and affluence and technology, deserve its own area of explanation in terms of the role that it plays. And I'm not going to really spend time there. It's just, you get the picture. But some people say, well, what about population? Well, that, okay, we could talk about that. That isn't what we're going to talk about today, but it's an important component. But the affluence time, the technology, is one thing that the United States is particularly it's important that we as a culture have a cultural dialogue around that. So this is now moving away from Oregon values and beliefs. This is a question we ask in a whole set of questions, which are worldview questions, like kind of belief in the Almighty and et cetera, you know, the hierarchical role of men and families and things like this. And one of the questions was, our country would be better off, a better place if we all consumed less, looking for a response of the American value towards frugality and thrift. And really quite surprised that it was an 87% level of agreement. And we really went into a lot of depth looking at that, spent about 2.5 years of work looking at this particular topic, because in some respects, this is an important pathway to that IPAT formula in terms of what that means. So what was really interesting about that is that when we were looking at global warming concern, is that you, on the Republican side of the equation, in that red bar, 34% will say that they're concerned with climate change. But when you talk about our country would be better off if we all consumed less, that jumps up to 64%. So we go from minority to majority in Republicans, and in Democrats it's virtually the same. And when we looked at that question, looking at global warming concern, say, compared to our country would be better off if we all consumed less of Christian conservatives went from 45% up to 64%, and environmentalists went nudged up within the margin of error in the same way. So we think it's a matter of a different statement, but the same result, but the result ends up being stronger when we start talking about consuming less, because it taps into this basic human value having to do with thrift and being economical with resources. So if that were the case, with roughly 2/3 of consumers saying they care. Now, you can see this is attributed to Dana O'Rourke commenting on a book report, but it's, so why is ethical consumption so minimal and so rarely transformative? And this is the lead-in to the distinction between attitude and behavior. And what we know is that this is true. We you know, oh, yes, I believe in going to church every Sunday, but how often do you do it? Oh, maybe I get there on Easter Sunday, or whatever the case may be. And there's just so many versions of what our attitudes are and what our behaviors are. And what we know is that attitudes do really inform our behavior. But what we know through studying of the social science is that behaviors actually inform attitudes more heavily than attitudes inform behaviors, which means to suggest, leading into the kind of the thing about how social change happens, is that if we walk the talk, we form the values and we strengthen those. So that if we're not walking the talk, then we're going to be in this kind of form that we call cognitive dissonance. We attitudinally believe something is important, but there's a disconnect. And that, sorry for the color rendition here, but that dissonance yields anxiety and grief and avoidance and denial, and it creates circumstances such as in our country, where we have a very high disproportionate amount of pharmaceuticals which are to address stress. I mean, there are many reasons for that, but one of them is that we have values over here and we have behaviors over here, and they're not always synonymous with each other. And I'm going to kind of, you can see the constraints, the habits, the norms, our conformity norms, our self-identity, our social ideologies. These are the constraints, the desires that we have, the physical constraints. I can't take the bus. It's two blocks away, or it's 2 miles away. There's all, and some of those physical constraints are real, why we can't behave the way that we do, but the way that we would like to. And some of them are basically contrived or rationales and forms. So this is Tim Jackson, a great quote. It's naive to ask consumers to voluntarily downscale and give up their desires without offering them alternative dreams. And we've looked at this. So what is a good way of coming at that? And we think that life satisfaction is a good one. What, in other words, if you're satisfied with life, what more is there? And so we've looked at this in terms of the United States. Here's income on the red bar at about $50,000 a year, average income per capita. Our carbon emissions are 17.5 tons per capita. Our self-reported well-being, our life satisfaction, this is a famous Gallup survey question that is asked once a year. They do it across the world. It's 140 countries. It's great for us to use their data and then run our data, say, on a subscale like Oregon. And we did it a few months apart. And we got 7.5 to the United States, 7.4, and we know, based upon the evidence, that Oregon is quite a bit lower on carbon emissions. But let's talk about carbon emissions a little bit. You see the United States at 17.5 tons per capita. I'm not going to talk about China. You can see that at 7.7 tons per capita. It's a great topic because a lot of people are saying, oh, well, the United States, we're now below where China is. But on a per capita basis, that certainly isn't true. And then there's a series of researchers that have looked at where we need to be in order to be truly sustainable. And that range is a little below 2 to a little below 4. So 2 to 5 tons is sort of the conceptual target where we should be. And on this per capita tonnage, in fact, China, 33% of their carbon emissions is based upon their exports. And one could say, the United States gets an extra 2.2 tons based upon their imports from Asian countries. And one could say that in some respects, that's really what it looks like, based upon consumption-based rather than production-based carbon emissions. And I'm going to wrap with this one. This is going to be my last slide. I have a little more here, but maybe it'll come up in Q&A. But now over on the left-hand side is where you have these three metrics of emissions and income per capita and self-reported well-being. And I've normalized those so that we can go take each one of those in comparison. And using the same metric across Oregon, Costa Rica, New Zealand, and Sweden. And I picked these three nation states because each one has a special story to tell. And I'm not going to talk about those stories very much, but Costa Rica, definitely within that, at the low end of that sustainable range. And yet, their life story, self-reported well-being is very high. And that's really high. That was the highest in the world at the time that this was taken. And there's reasons for that. That's part of the dialogue. But we need to look at kind of what we're pursuing and the pursuit of what wealth or the pursuit of well-being, which is it going to be? And there's a lot of discussions in the culture around that. If we look at, some people discount Costa Rica because, oh, they're in a warm climate and, you know, they don't have to heat their house. But they do live modestly, and that's the reason. They could have air conditioners. They don't. They have open breezeways and things like that. But New Zealand is a climate that is slightly colder. That's another story. There's a story around why New Zealand, there's a brand new study out that has just been started on looking at both subjective and objective well-being measurements, and New Zealand ranks the highest of all the countries in the world on that combined metric of that. And it isn't shown in this green bar here, their well-being at slightly higher than the United States. They're down around 7.2. That's going up a little bit of recent. And their income is about a little more than half of ours. And then there's Sweden, which is a very cold country, highly industrialized. They have a lot of industrial processes at 5.5 tons. So that, I guess why I'm really pointing at this is that part of this is the cultural conversation that we really could have about looking at what our goals are in a way to become truly sustainable and have a check-in with what our policies are and engage our leadership as well as our own personal behaviors in terms of how we get there. And the only thing in closing that I'd like to say is that back in the year 2000, I made a personal decision that I was going to try to get down in that category of what was sustainable. That range that was given was still kind of kicking around back then. And I did such things as changing a 25 mile per gallon car to a 50 gallon. And then I started working from home. And I now drive about once a week, a couple of times a week. The model that I have is not everybody can do that. However, it's being intentional about my decisions in terms of how I organize my life. And I think more people can do that than they give themselves credit sometimes. And so there's other aspects that go with that in my lifestyle, how big my house is. And this is the intentional decisions. I'm in a 750 square foot house. You know, it's well insulated. All of that helps me to get to my 4 tons of emitted carbon, and I'm still living an American lifestyle. When it comes time for me to make the next step down to 3 or down to 2, it's not a very long step anymore. And I feel like I'm prepared to do that because I know that there's still areas that I could improve my own situation. Gee, there's something to be said here, but I'm going to let it go. It just goes to show that where we are on the long term, there is a not a one-to-one relationship between wealth, but there's a fairly strong correlation between how much we earn and what our carbon emissions are, about a 0.5. Every time our income goes up, an increment about half of that, our carbon footprint is likely to go up. But that's such a complicated subject because it varies so much between individual choices. But generally speaking, we see that wealthy people are going to be emitting more carbon on a personal behavior basis than people that are on the low income level. And I'll also emphasize that people that are at the low income level are not seeking to have higher incomes as much as our policymakers would say that if we only bring the bottom up, we'll be able to solve those problems. The people that have the strongest orientation to address environmental issues are down at the lower income levels. It's really quite remarkable. I think I'm about done here. Maybe we can take it over to a question and answer. Thanks very much.
Our first questioner today is Julie Daniel, the Executive Director of Bring Recycling. Julie.
So thanks, Tom. We really appreciate your work on climate change and everything you've done for social research. I think you've really shown very, very clearly that most Oregonians agree that climate change is real. We care about it. There's the whole piece around consumption. All that's true. But as you've also pointed out, that agreeing with a value and actually living it are two very different things. The United Way of Lane County's most recent report done in 2012 showed that 50% of our students are eligible for free and reduced lunches. 44% of our households pay more than a third of their income for housing, putting families at economic risk. And 30% of our young people don't even graduate from high school. So minus the sort of direct threats that spur outrage and action, the people most likely to make lifestyle changes usually have one of two characteristics, or both of them, financial stability and education. With so many people struggling on the economic edge right here in our community, how do we make climate change broadly relevant and not an elitist issue that only those of us with enough bandwidth in our lives have the freedom to address?
Well, I would say a couple of things. First of all, I want to acknowledge Robin Quirk, who's one of my research colleagues over here. She's just about to get her master's degree in social psychology, and I have two other colleagues that I work with fairly regularly that are PhDs in social psychology. I was going to say that I am not a social psychologist. I have a background in architecture, and I like to think that it's ideal for doing this kind of research because architecture is one of those fields that merges the physical sciences and the social sciences in reaching solutions. Now to your question, which is a kind of a social science kind of question. So we've been doing interviews with people that are voluntarily low carbon emitters, and many of them are low income. And I think what I hear you saying is that there is a relationship between having the wealth or the latitude or the education to make those decisions. I know one individual who I believe that the write-up hasn't been done yet, but earns $200 a month and a very, very low carbon footprint, lives this voluntarily. I think that one of the misnomers is that we are inherently, we have the stereotype that only the people that have enough money can make decisions and have that kind of flexibility. We find that tends not to be the case. that we have higher income individuals and highly educated individuals that are making high emission behavior decisions. I know a professor at the University of Oregon that commutes to teach in a social science category at the University of Oregon from Portland. And I also know that, I could give other examples like that. I think we need to be careful about those kinds of stereotypes and give everybody the latitude to work through this idea and make decisions, and also to recognize that from the studies that we've been looking at in the income categorization or the education categorization, that low-income people are often people that have a high school education are supportive of these lifestyle changes, perhaps in part because it's a motivated rationale, like if I haven't attained it, I can, you know, it's a justification. On the other hand, I think I'd just be careful about that in terms of jumping to the conclusion that that's what we need in order to get there, is that all of these kind of other trappings of cultural elevation that come with the way you were describing. I don't know, does that help?
And now it's time to take a break for you to form questions for our speaker, Tom Bowerman. As a reminder, the website with the slides on it, for those of you in our radio audience, is policyinteractive.com/cityclub, and we'll take a quick 5-minute break for you to compose your questions. Please do come up to the front when you have one so we can know we're ready to start again.
You're listening to KLCC Eugene 89.7, KLCO Newport 90.5, KLFR Reedsport 89.1, at 88.1, KLBR Bend, KLFO Florence, KMPQ Roseburg, and on the web, klcc.org.
Welcome back to City Club of Eugene for our program on changing attitudes about climate change with our speaker, Tom Bowerman. As a reminder, the slides he's referring to and ably describing are available at policyinteractive.com/cityclub. And now to your questions.
Hello, I'm John. Excuse me. I'm John Anik, City Club member since 2002. And the question is, for doing something positive about reducing the effects of global warming, what do you see as the effect of recent U.S. Supreme Court decisions, such as Citizens United and the McCutcheon decision, that have ended the limits on political donations?
I think it's a significant, tangible connection. I mean, if that's a yes or no, excuse me?
We can't hear you.
Oh, okay. My answer is that it is there is a connection. Our response in my organization has been working on campaign finance reform in Oregon. Oregon is one of four or three, depending on who's doing the counting, states in the nation that has no limits. We have a bill that was written by Policy Interactive staff that's sitting in the legislature. I think it has to be reintroduced each time. Couldn't get it out of committee. It's not just the Supreme Court that we're talking about of the federal government. It's the Oregon legislature could move this forward aggressively, and they aren't. So I completely agree. It's a very profound component of looking forward, and not just climate change, a whole set of issues that we have in terms of addressing problems in our culture.
My name is Kevin Matthews. I've been a City Club member off and on for many years. Tom, thanks for the great presentation. My table's question is, how do you think these issues will play out differently between rural and urban areas in Oregon?
I have no idea how the, I mean, I can't even quite wrap my head around the question, how do they play out differently? We know that rural areas are more dependent upon surface transportation. There's a component there. We also know that rural areas can grow more of their own food, be more self-reliant. These are offsetting circumstances. Julie at the table that I was sitting at was talking about an experience she had years ago where they lived in a rural area where they, you know, was that kind of quasi-hippie era out in Deadwood. And they lived very inexpensively through barter and trade and self-reliance. And certainly that is a possibility in the rural areas, that it's much more difficult to do that in urban areas. So all of these sort of relationships are so contextual and nuanced, and it's so dependent on individual circumstances. I think it's one of those processes that everybody kind of goes through and looks at what their opportunities for addressing this in creative ways are. That's about the best I can come up with at the moment.
Hi, Tom. Great presentation. Alan Zelenka, City Club member since 1991. Our questions revolved around income and action. And it doesn't seem like a lot is happening. And part of that is the ability to act is seems like it's based somewhat on income, like only rich people can afford high MPG cars kind of thing. Is this true, and how do we deal with it? And the second part of that is, and the other problem about actions, is the effects of climate change seem to be long-term, but the actions we need to take to prevent that are short-term. And so there seems to be this dissonance between what we see and what might happen. And so and with our tendency to focus on immediate gratification, how do we overcome that problem? Or do we have to wait until we see really bad outcomes and impacts here locally for us to act?
You have two questions, and I'd rather focus on the harder one, which is the second one, which is we're dealing with a circumstance which is in the future, which we can't see, and so the daily events trump that. Part of the presentation that I showed you earlier was to try to think about those dreams and aspirations, which we might actually live a more enjoyable life, we might be happier, we might have more life satisfaction if we took on that question around how much we need to earn, whether or not the pursuit of wealth is the primary goal of our life, or at least a leading goal. I think that we're so inculcated in our culture to think of that as a objective. It's almost, we've become dyed in the wool on that, and it's hard to break free from that and say that we can just simply let some of that go on a big... We do know that if you're talking about income, and I think the income question is really an interesting and an important one. We just did a national survey looking at the relationship of self-reported well-being, that single measure, at the income level. And the income level really levels right out at around $35,000. And other people have done studies on objective measures of well-being and found out that the income level really functionally on an individual basis levels out pretty quickly at about $10,000. And there's a lot of countervening circumstances which will influence that. If you happen to live in a very wealthy culture, and you might be able to get by with $10,000, but your kids can't get the $100 pair of sneakers and things like that, that's going to influence whether or not you have that self. If your kids are really complaining because their peer group have things that they don't have, that's going to influence your well-being. So I think that what I'm really encouraging to stir the cultural dialogue around is, could we really open this conversation up and sort of do a reality check on how much do we really need to be happy or to be well off?
Hi, Sue Walling, City Club member. Our table had a pretty easy question. In looking at the other countries that you mentioned, how does Sweden do it, and what lessons does that hold for us?
Well, Sweden has a carbon tax of $150 per ton of emitted carbon. That's sitting up at around $1.20 a gallon of fuel, I believe. I can't remember. It's about that. They have one of the strongest economies in the world. It's just incredible when we hear that we can't do this because it's going to put us at an economic disadvantage. And Sweden stepped out there in 1991 and started at $100 a ton of emitted carbon. What this does is that it drives through the marketplace substantial levels of change that puts them on a low carbon trajectory. And the legislature in Oregon has started a study of carbon tax and has allocated some funds to Portland State to look at this. They started looking at the idea of a West Coast carbon tax structure, also using British Columbia, which does have a revenue neutral, it's called, carbon tax of $30 a ton. So it's not close to Sweden. How do they get there? How does Sweden, for example, get there? Very intentionally. And it's truly a democracy. It's not an autocratic decision-making process, but we have to soften up our own will to be able to realize that maybe that's a constructive path to get there. And Sweden's tax pays for the transitional technologies to be able to service a broad egalitarian society so that they can get around with public transportation. So that in and of itself is a whole other topic, but that's my quick answer for Sweden.
Hi, Linda Jensen, City Club member since 2010. On a similar vein, our table was wondering, now that we have a good idea of what the public values are, how we go about getting these stated values translated into changes in policy in order to lower our carbon emissions.
I think that's the kind of the big question, you've got a representative over there. Maybe he'll come up and tell us how to do that. I have a lot of admiration for that guy, and at the same time, I feel like one of the things that's going to be helpful is for people to begin connecting that attitude behavior gap, and that's a driver. We have to have more working examples that we can do this. That's what I've been trying to do with my own life, to exemplify it. I'm not the only one. There are a lot of people that are working on this in our culture. It's going to have to sweep through the, we're going to have some sort of snowball effect here, but certainly it has to be stated that we need to lean on these representatives of ourselves, that our elected officials, not just the political leaders, but the elite, kind of the ones that are in control. We have to be talking about this all the time. That's what my complaint about the voters pamphlet is, how little it has been mentioned in the primary election. And I would like to see a lot more leadership from our elected officials to bring it to the bully pulpit and talk about it and get it out there and weather the storm and have it be part of the conversation.
Jerry Smith, City Club member. This is aimed kind of at you, Tom. Can you ask a new question, a question regarding rapidly replacing fossil fuel industry with green industry, incentivizing green investments with new jobs and new techniques, such as new housing, transportation, using solar, wind, hydrogen, etc. I grew up in World War II, and in 3 years, we went from a wildly consumer economy that was broke, more broke than we are now, into being an absolutely booming wartime industry. I think that rapid mobilization is necessary, because I'm hearing some scientists say mass extinctions could begin in as little as 14 years. We haven't got a whole lot of time. So my question is, can you ask people how rapidly they can change or willing to change to save their lives?
Well, I think your question really was how quickly we could ramp up renewable technologies in the transition so we can disconnect from the fossil fuel. And not very quickly, actually. Even if we went full speed ahead, the amount of energy that drives our economy at present, I've seen those figures. I don't have them on the top of my head, but I don't think you can get there from here within the time frame that we're talking about. There are also, I will emphasize, there are some studies that suggest that the renewable technologies are sometimes overstated in their contribution to release us, that they, for example, the ethanol, there's a several new studies that have come out in the last couple of months about corn ethanol and cellulose ethanol, and they're actually taking more energy, more fossil fuel energy than they displace to be able to continue to work on those. And so the concern that I have is that that may not be, I think it is a leg on the stool, but it's not the only leg on the stool. A leg on the stool has to be this transformational way of thinking and rethinking how much we need to have in terms of material support for our well-being, and that's going to be a real important part of this transition.
I'm Merlin Huff, City Club member for several years. And at our table, it seems that there's important actions that are needed both on the governmental policy institutional side as well as on the personal choice, opinions, behavior side. And from what you see and hear and understand, what would be those top few things in each of those two categories that you think are most critical at this point?
Well, I think that on a personal level, it's always being very open to how change can occur in your own life. It's like that transformational way of thinking, making a profound inner reach for those sorts of things that I can change in my life that allows me to release from my connections. And I showed you those that slide about kind of the self-identity that we have, why we choose certain pathways. It's challenging our social norms. We have a whole set of social norms that operate in this culture, which are fairly constraining to be able to break free of. And it takes a pretty strong individual to be able to basically cut loose and take a different pathway. But the more people that do that, we start creating new social norms. And so that's the thing, is that I think just internally, individually, taking a deep look, taking a deep breath, looking within our soul around how we live. And in terms of the policy structure, that's a tougher one for me because I'm not a policymaker. I understand some of the difficulties, but I do think that being more, making a longer reach. If I were to use the analogy to Tom McCall, and if you've seen and have read the book that he went through and how he was innovative and how he took those reaches, how he stepped out there and how he walked the plank, you might say, and lived to tell about it for quite a bit of his tenure, and much of the advancements that we still have in our repertoire of being considering ourselves a green state came from that era, much more than we have now. There are other states that are making advancements well beyond the state of Oregon now.
I'm Mary Layton, a City Club member since 2006, and our question asks you to take a stab at the intersection between two sets, that is, behaviors that we don't mind changing so much and behaviors that would make a difference pretty quickly, if not a huge difference, but an immediately a visible difference in our carbon footprint. So some things, there was composting toilets we were talking about in the 70s, and they really would make a huge difference and could be used in lots of places, but people were really not willing to give up the notion that flushing away was the right thing to do with waste. So that was too far. What are things that we could do that you think are doable, that people could be talked into doing without so much trouble, that would begin to make a difference right away?
I'm not a big fan of the 100 easy steps to solve climate change.
The journey of 1,000 miles begins with the first steps.
and sometimes those little steps are just enough to let us off the hook. We think that I've recycled my newspapers. What else do you want me to do? You know, and I think that I would really challenge us to say that it's time to maybe look at some of the big steps. One of the things that I didn't quite mention up there is that airplane travel, when we've done interviews, and people, we were trying to ask them about their carbon footprint estimated beforehand, and then looked at that, and it's remarkable how many people don't think that airplanes emit carbon, or that when they look at their carbon footprint, oh, I guess that was because I didn't count the airplane trips, right? And the thing that also people don't understand is that there's that component of radiative forcing from high altitude emissions that an airplane, a modern airplane, may get 60 passenger miles per gallon. That is, you take and fill up all the seats and you take them out, the amount of fuel goes through. But what that doesn't count is that the emissions at that altitude are more like driving an SUV by yourself across the country. In other words, when you're sitting in that seat, that's, you'd be better off to take an SUV with two people in it driving on the surface rather than taking jetliner across the country. And so those are points, and when we've been doing these interviews with qualitative interviews with individuals trying to kind of untangle this attitude behavior divide kind of thing, there's a lot of kind of discretionary travel and behaviors that I think really one of the, so I know one professor that traveled to Reykjavik for the opening of an ice museum, you know. It wasn't even his occupational area of zone, you know. And when I asked him why that was, he said, I belong to an institution which expects me to go long distances, the further the better, to advance the university as being an international research organization. And by way of comparison, not to beat up on all the professors, there's another one that I did a presentation with at the law school, at the Pell Conference the year before. And when he went to the East Coast, he went and stayed for 9 months. He isn't quite back yet. So he went and he took his wife, and they took a month to get there, surface travel, and a month to get back. So they're making a total event out of this process. And he is the example that I like to use that's totally committed to addressing climate change. And he can live within that carbon budget of four and still travel to the East Coast. But rather than going for, there's another teacher that I know that went to a conference in Venice, Italy, for a 20-minute panel, and didn't even stay for the whole conference. And so these are examples of sort of like, now is that a big step or is that a little step? You know, I don't know, but these are big emissions. I know we had one person we interviewed that flew 80,000 miles in the year that we interviewed him. So those are big deals, and that's part of the conversation that we need to have. And try to do it with a warm heart, but at the same time, the hard conversation.
Ruth Daimler, I'd like to hear your examples, Tom. I think they're important, and I think if we repeat examples, it helps. It seems like our community or our state is really going often, and other states are going in the wrong direction right now. For instance, biomass puts out more carbon than coal, and we're seeing an increase in biomass throughout the country, and it is not a renewable fuel. They can call it that. It isn't renewable. It takes 30, 40, 50 years to be renewable. Meanwhile, the carbon emissions grow. Also, I heard on the news that quite a few states are considering, and some states have already adapted, with 80-mile-an-hour speed limit. And that uses twice as much fuel as if you're going 45 or 50 miles an hour. So the carbon level increases as we increase the speed limit. Do you think that our state will ever see it lowering down to 50 miles an hour and enough people will learn that they're using up valuable fuel and carbon is putting out when we drive fast? Is there a chance?
I have no idea on that. I still think that probably one of the best ways to address that is probably to price carbon, and to bring a carbon pricing mechanism into play so that it really, but, you know, I would also say some concern about just pricing carbon. I mean, this is my own kind of a, I'm, I'm about 50-50 egalitarian and individualist. And one of the concerns that I have is that if you price carbon, the people that don't have very much money are going to be, it's going to be a kind of a regressive component. That is, people mm-hmm. that are wealthy probably won't change their lifestyle a bit if they have enough wealth. Other people that, but if that's the way we have to get there, if that's the way it is, I'm still for it. But I think that the idea of carbon rationing would be ultimately a fairer approach.
Well, I don't know if you know, in the past, we have put a price on emissions. And when we do that, we've seen the emissions in the plants go down. Yeah. So it's, as an example, other places have done it. We could use that example and make sure that happens. I hope it will. Thank you.
Thank you.
James Baldock, City Club member since 2012. I guess I'm just going to follow up on you. You mentioned about pricing carbon, and to my knowledge, there's kind of two different ways to do it, just a flat carbon tax and a cap and trade scheme. If you could maybe describe what the difference between the two are and whether you have a personal preference, so I can call my congressman and tell him which one to do, that'd be great.
Well, the cap and trades have not worked out particularly well, not because the idea is entirely flawed, but it's a very complicated system, and it's also subject to manipulation. And to some extent, the actual carbon pricing of flat tax on, or a maybe even a progressive tax structure, is more transparent. And it appears to be working more effectively. So my preference is, I would also say from all of the reading that I've done, the economists that are worried about climate change or have that on their agenda to study are much more favorable to the idea of a carbon tax rather than a cap and trade. So I think that it strongly tips in favor of some form of pricing carbon through carbon tax structure.
Well, thank you, Tom Bauerman, for bringing clarity and vision to this City Club program on changing attitudes about climate change. As a reminder, you can catch the slides that he described for us today at policyinteractive.com/cityclub. And thanks again to our sponsors, Sacred Earth Botanicals, Sanipac, and KLCC. We meet next again on next Friday, May 9th, at the Downtown Athletic Club to hear How Inequality Affects You with David K. Johnston, a national author. Lunches for this program can be ordered on the City Club's website or by contacting the office. We look forward to seeing you there. Thank you.
The sun went down, and then you'd fill him a jug and he'd pass it around. Mighty, mighty pleasing, Pappy's corn squeezing.
Shh, white lightning.
Well, the G-men, T-men, revenueers too, searching for a place where he made his brew. They were looking, trying to book him, but my Pappy kept on cooking.
Shh, white lightning.
Of Mountain Dew. I took a little sip and right away I knew, as my eyes bugged out and my face turned blue. Lightning started flashing, thunder started clashing.
White lightning.
Well, the G-men, T-men, revenueers too, searching for a place where he made his brew. They were looking, trying to book him, but my pappy kept on cooking.
Why lightning?
Well, a city slicker came and he said, I'm tough. I think I want to taste that powerful stuff. He took one slug and he drank it right down, and I heard him
my morning as he hit the ground. Mighty, mighty pleasing, your pappy's corn's pleasing.
Whew, white lightning.
G-men, revenue is two. Searching for a place where it made you through. They were looking, trying to book him, but my pappy kept on cooking.
White lightning.